All right, good morning, guys. How was how mine? You're in Poland. You're actually in Poland. You're from Poland and you're in Poland today, right?
I'm from Poland. I'm in Poland. Yes, I'm in Warsaw,
Okay.
admiring the beautiful city.
So no sunglasses. Okay, guys, so today we're going to discuss transport and logistics about a company specifically that's raised a 1 million seed round. And the founders have an interesting background, not from construction. Actually, from finance. We may also touch, if we get time, on the real Slim Shadys of construction because they are back again. There's a very famous story, maybe the most famous construction tech story, and the upper management team have created a new company based in Florida, so they're back. And if we get time, we may touch on Patrick's advice on boards as well. So, welcome to the Bricks and Bytes broadcast with Patrick Hallerman, a weekly digest of the hottest construction tech news. But before we get started, Patrick, you look a little bit different today. I think you are bathing in the glory of the relaunch of AECVC and extra bonus video content.
Thank you. Yeah, morning, guys. Yeah, indeed. I hadn't been at it for 6 months, during which I had thought how to transfer my slide deck format into like a video format. Finally relaunched. Feels good.
Yeah,
Very
we're
good.
looking forward to see it.
We're looking forward to seeing more of mine. Have you not seen the one that came out this week? So, anyway, mine, do you want to kick us off with the company in question, Alric?
Yes, so we're going to discuss Alric. So it specifically targets the construction sector with its software that enables supervise and monitor fleet activity on a centralized system. So I really don't know much about it. So I would say, and what do you think about Alric and similar type of business?
Nicely done.
That's a very good swerve, curveball. Well, first off, the first thing that comes to my head, we're talking about construction tech. Is this construction tech? Maybe.
It's a very good question, actually.
It's logistics, which I suppose feeds
So in
into construction
my
somehow.
very like a broad, very broad, not very narrow understanding of the space, it feels like they improve the productivity of internal fleet management. And what it means is that the companies which use them, they can do more within the same time. And the byproduct of that is they are more sustainable because they can do more within kind of the same. But in my head, the companies will squeeze the extra capacity within the saving. So I struggle to see this sustainability improvement, but perhaps I'm wrong, like most of the times.
Yeah, let's touch on that quickly then, and then I'll ask Patrick a question. So the value proposition, I got this from a PR piece or a research piece, was that reduced costs per delivery is 26% and reduced emissions by 33%. So the reduced emissions is obviously important for like sustainability and that kind of thing. But how do we measure, like how does a company or a startup, how do we measure that? Is there a way? How do we measure this 33% reduction? Do you know?
Do I know or do I?
Eva.
Oh, Patrick, what do you think?
So I haven't looked at this space from an emissions angle, I have to say. So I'll punt on the emissions question. But when it comes to, I do think that logistics and construction tech intersect very strongly. Because if you think about how you optimize construction, it's always through the supply chains. It's never through, oh, let's squeeze another hour of battery life out of a power tool, right? So it's not an operations problem like that. It's a supply chain problem. So I do think there's a strong intersection between those. And what Alric does is it allows suppliers within the construction trades organize shipments to construction customers, mainly sites. Online. So basically, there's a shipment planner module in the software, and then there's a B2B marketplace. Think of it a little bit like freight forwarding, but on a more local scale that you can organize this with. I wouldn't trust myself to make a judgment on the emissions impact there, Owen, but on the economic impact, I think they are riding on two different, let's say, ground truths about construction. One is that it's a supply chain optimized business, as I just said, and the other one is from the supplier side. We're running into a massive truck driver shortage, and you need to find more and more efficiencies to give you an idea, in Europe, we're already short 650,000 truck drivers today across industries. By 2030, we'll be 1 million short, and shortly after 2030, we'll be 1.5 million short. So to get trucks, to get goods on site via trucks is going to be harder and harder. And everybody that is operating a fleet or that is dependent on fleets making shipments has realized that. So whatever efficiency you can squeeze out is currently getting looked at by suppliers that rely on fleets. And so that's where Alrik sits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. The other part of this equation seems like can be also autonomous vehicles, and perhaps the trucks will be driving themselves at some point in the future. I think Europe is very far from that. I don't think in Europe we can have autonomous driving, right? The US, I saw in San Francisco, in Texas, they tried it quite a lot.
So I will say, so this is not my viewpoint, because I'm not educated enough on the autonomous highway trucking. We are invested in autonomous trucking for off-road with Safe AI in the US, which is a very different animal, because you have different environment, you don't have the road traffic that you have to account for. So that part we understand, but the on-highway, we don't currently have a strong view. So I'll just cite a super high-level automotive manager that I spoke to about this just last year. He's working for one of the largest OEMs out there as a board member, and he said, and he's an engineer, having led R&D for that company for a long time. And he said, Patrick, not in 20 years will we have on-highway truck autonomy. Take that for what it's worth. Everybody will have a different view here.
Mm. Okay, so more on this piece. So apparently there's 23% downtime on sites on construction sites due to prolonged waiting for goods, and that's a direct effect of lack of real-time visibility. One thing that's also worth noting is the founders. So the founders are from a finance background. They've gone from finance to logistics and construction. Which one do you guys think is more exciting, finance or logistics, from a career choice perspective?
Finance. Finance, yeah.
How so?
Well, it probably allows them to focus more on the commercial aspect of the business or a startup. And I've listened to a podcast probably years ago now, and they were saying that I think 80 or 90% of 1 billion dollar businesses are founders who have commercial focus, and they come from different background than the background startup that they founded in. So, which actually gives an interesting insight that these engineers focus on very narrow disciplines. They are not always like commercially focused enough to get the business into this scale of $1 billion business. So that's why I think that.
My answer would be logistics. I think when you try to solve all these little, we start our drinking game now, guys. Nuances.
Here we go.
Around construction, and then you have the intersection with logistics. There's a ton of them, and so you will have an advantage of actually knowing what that is, which rocks to look under. There's also an ability to connect with people on a different level if you have their background in our industries. There's a track record element to it. There's a reputational element to it. A mix of both is, I think, kind of ideal. Now, Nikki and Axel, they're both from a fintech background and quite accomplished in what they did before. So either way, they'll figure it out.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's always an interesting debate that we have on the podcast from time to time. Is like, in order to succeed, well, let's just take construction tech. Do you need to have a background in construction? And the argument is actually very balanced. Some people are like very convicted that yes, you do, and some are like, no, not really.
I mean, some of the you can't bake setups, right? So setups are, in the end, human connection between founders, and suddenly they happen. So it's not like someone sits at a drawing board and says, oh, this is the kind of team I picked together. It never works like that. But if you could, then a combination of, you know, not from construction and other past experience that is relevant to the business you're building in construction tech, and then some construction or logistics or supply chain experience. Like, that's an ideal combination if you can find that.
Yeah,
very nice.
Yes.
Do we know any?
Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, do we know any similar companies that are doing what Auric are doing?
So the I've been actually actively scouting the logistics around construction sites since 2020. I originally started with a thesis that you can build a very substantial business doing warehousing for construction, not the way Renorun did it, more the way that you would do warehousing as a service. There's an Indonesian company that does something like that, but for the manufacturing industry. And so we started in 2020 with a thesis, and to this day, I haven't seen a company that actually tackles that thesis. So if you want to talk to me about that, here I am, talk to me, bye-bye. But since then, there's been other companies that tackled it in their own right. So there was Renorun in the US, which unfortunately since has gone bust. And it was, I think they found it very difficult to make their specific model work, but it had a very strong component of organizing logistics for construction sites. In Germany, there's BEX, which is probably the closest comparison to Alrik. BEX is relatively advanced already in the number of shipments that they do per year, etc. And then the business I like is a business out of Denmark called SiteHub. And so what SiteHub does is, I think, really beautiful. They get on a construction site, so they don't come from the supplier side, and they help a construction site organize their supply chains, first starting as a service. So going to what we talk about here on Bricks and Bytes a lot, right? So not necessarily starting with the software first, but starting with the outcome first. That's what they do. And then they earn very big enterprise contracts for organizing the supply chain just for that specific site. And they earn their right to play there by doing it well. And then the customer goes to them, and this has happened multiple times for them, and says, hey, could you also take on this part of organizing my supply chain? Or could you take on the catering? Could you take on this and that? And then they do that. And as they do it, they build software in order to optimize their way of doing it. And in the end, they don't sell the software because the customers like it purchasing actually the outcome of a well-organized logistics. So they keep monetizing that. They just happen to do it better with software. And there's even these instances where then the customers say, hey, by the way, you capture all this data for us because you're using the software. And they go, yeah, sure. I mean, do you want the software? No. Wow. Keep the software, but I would like to have a report on this, this, and this. And then he sells them the report. So it's a really beautiful business around all the chaos, or bringing method and structure into all the chaos of the supply chain around the construction site that SiteHub is doing. I'm really liking that.
So I just wanted to explore one more like parameter here. You all mentioned that in Alrik example, the construction labor experiences 23% downtime on site due to prolonged waiting for goods, right? So my experience is that usually this downtime is because of the supply chain problems in terms of there's not enough factories producing the good, rather than finding the supply provider. So the best example I can give, so in the UK, if you want to delay someone's project, design windpost from company called Aecon, right? It's definitely going to be six weeks lead time. So
what about the lintels?
Lintels are fine, but the windpost.
Okay, because I'm just about to order a load.
Yeah. So
actually, they're bespoke, curved.
Yeah. So every single time I get a phone call, and can you please redesign it? Can you please change it for something else? So my experience is that usually this waiting time comes from the scarcity or not enough number of factories producing the thing, rather than like, oh, we call 50 suppliers, and you know, we're trying to figure out which one is going to deliver the thing first to us.
I would directionally agree. Oh, sorry, go on. Go.
I was going to say, I think they're more talking about like the people that are waiting to receive delivery. Once it's left the warehouse, the downtime associated with like maybe traffic or queues on site, because there's so many deliveries that will turn up around lunchtime, whatever time it might be. There's a lot of time wasted there. Patrick?
Yeah, I would directionally agree with both of you. I think the big delays happen due to manufacturing lags. I do think there's an element of, you know, we can't get just in time if we also fix the logistics being just in time. So I think that's how I've interpreted their number. And I think that that's probably right. In the German version of The Office, there's this guy that keeps saying, hey, you're also impunctual if you're too early. So that's the reality of a construction site manager, is the stuff never arrives on time. It also arrives too early. And that brings, now that's not the KPI that they cite here, but that brings other problems with it, because now you have to store the stuff on site, which exposes it to theft. I mean, let's talk theft on construction sites. That's a real problem. So then you don't have insurance for it, and the thing is gone tomorrow when you wanted to start work. It also just sits around, and you have to maneuver it around on a space-constrained construction site. It never gets as efficient as you would like it to be, because the stuff just sits there and it blocks your way if it gets there too early. Now, that's the point I was going to make about the warehousing for construction sites thesis. But so in general, I think we're trying to be more just in time. But to be that, you're right, Martin, you have to fix also the manufacturing side.
Yes, you raise a good point, I think, about... but if you are too early, you're not on time as well. I think I'm biased with the type of product I deal with. So I think that's a good point.
Yeah. Patrick, you mentioned the German version of The Office.
Yeah.
Is it funny?
I mean, if you have crude humor.
Okay, so we go to the upper management, who are back, as I touched on in the introduction. So... shout out to Brian from Construction Physics for an article that he released this week about a new company that's appeared on the scene, ONX Homes, pronounced Onyx Homes. So it's created by Michael Marks, and for people, maybe the people that listen to this podcast are quite familiar with the name, but he was the founder, right, of Katerra.
Yes.
So just a little bit of background about this new company. So far, they've raised $200 million. I will ask a question to you, Patrick, on that one, because they already burned through however many billion in previous companies. So I would wonder who would then want to put 200 million into this company.
That was different angle. This time was different.
This is probably an extreme case, but I don't know if that would happen to let's say the average founder. But anyway, ONX single family homes. It's a single family home building company in South Florida. They use precast concrete walls, slabs, foundations. Martin, this is interesting. Precast.
Yeah, I've seen that for the last 10 years. Okay. In Europe and in the UK. And unless it's kind of printed and delivered by helicopter, I don't see anything new in this model, actually. as I've seen so many companies. I even worked in one.
I saw something new, by the way. They said that there's something like 33 subcontractors on to build a home. And I did try and do a quick count before we went live. And I think I got to about six. So I'm interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, carry on.
So I think they have great marketing, and they're showing very brilliantly how this is done on site. So that's a good thing. Other than that, I probably don't know enough to kind of to give my full opinion on this. But look forward to getting to know more about Onyx, really. Patrick, what do you think?
Yeah, Patrick, I think can you just help us out with the issue of the amount of funding?
Okay, about that specifically?
I mean, 200 million is a lot, right? For offsite concrete precast manufacturer.
It's a lot in general, and it is even more, an even more lot. Is that how you say it? An even more lot?
We'll take it.
Yeah, in like the first few years of a company. Yeah, for sure. If I was a shareholder, it wouldn't be something that would excite me if my company had raised that much in a short amount of time, because... typically constraints breed art. And so if you're unconstrained, you also spend resources on things that perhaps you shouldn't be doing. I mean, it's as close to a first principle as there is around this. And so with it come dumb decisions, risky decisions, decisions that you shouldn't have taken, decisions with low ROI. But the founder who raises this amount of money, in my experience, typically makes the opposite argument in the situation. They say, no, I can do all these things that make sense, and I have this grand vision, and I'm going to put all the puzzle pieces together. I'm going to become defensible because of it. I increase the distance to my peers, etc. I have honestly rarely seen it out that way, and I have too often seen it play out the other way, where you're doing all the low ROI things and in the end you suffer from it. So no, as a shareholder, I would not be excited if my company was in this position, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Just on the technology of the like reinforced concrete like versus, for example, timber frame panels, I think concrete buildings are much more difficult in the future to adapt, to refurbish them or to change them, to change the structural layout of those. So I prefer much, I much more prefer timber as, you know, in 20, 30 years, you can adapt to change it very, very easily within these kind of concrete pots and concrete elements. It's very difficult to figure out like how can you refurbish it or do some structural alterations to them and being certain that what you do is correct. So
it's way less sustainable as well, concrete, eh? Than timber.
Yeah, I saw also on the website that they said sustainable, like which I rolled my eyes, like how is concrete more sustainable? But maybe there are some metrics on that, but I really struggle to see it.
So they say they're using green concrete. Have we found the green concrete yet?
You mean painted in green?
I mean, there are ways to reduce the amount of cement in concrete. And if you don't apply it to like the super structural elements, you can get away probably with a relatively decent amount of binding material, usually being the cement in it. You can make some alternative cementitious materials. You can add some additives to it. There's ways how you can, especially if you do it precast, because you control the curing process quite well. You can make it greener than like the ready mix concrete that you would typically have in like a tunnel pour or something like that. I'm guessing that's what they mean. So there's some truth to it.
Hmm. Patrick, have you looked at any like offsite manufacturers within your portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, for us, we're only convinced in two types of models there. So one is a model that is, and that's been my main gripe with Katerra. One is a model that is an asset-light supply chain network. So you don't try to become the manufacturing owner or the factory owner. You don't try to own the entire supply chain, but rather your thesis is, hey, there's so much competence in this, let's pour one, nuanced business. And you need all these competencies that have developed over decades, but you can bring them together better in a more structured and aligned way. And to do that, you prescribe the design, you prescribe the software onto which they need to collaborate together. You prescribe when everything is going to get produced, to your point, Martin, right, is getting it just in time. You organize the financing, the permitting, and then you orchestrate everything. So that's as close as to what an automotive OEM model with their relatively large supply base would look like. So that's one model. It's like an asset-light supply chain orchestration. In our portfolio, for example, a Spanish company called 011H does that model, but there are other companies that do it as well. And the other one is one where, but I have to find one that I'm really excited about, where you would have a very high roboticized content in the business, and you would dedicate vertically, like very, very vertically to specific assets. So that's another one. But anything that is kind of in between doesn't excite me.
Very nice. Shall we think about wrapping this up? Martin,
yeah, maybe that one generic question. Like, how do venture capitalists in construction or construtech think about charging models for software as a service, for example, or general other services which startups provide?
Man, I'm looking forward to your white paper on this. By the way, I've heard this question more times than I can remember.
This ties into something different that I'm thinking of a lot, which is like the technology should be deflationary, should be increasing the cost of produced goods and services. And I just see the opposite quite a lot. That's what I'm very curious to figure out the investor side of it.
I mean, there's a very conventional wisdom among VCs when it comes to the pricing of software as a service, and it's if you ask 10 out of 10 generic investors out there, it will be, oh, I want subscription revenue that is recurring. Ideally, it's a most investors will say they would like to have annual subscriptions because it's, you know, highest reliability. There will be a few outliers investors who will say, I prefer monthly subscriptions because I can control my churn better, because on annual contracts, I only see who's churning after a year. So that there's like that, I would say, as most of the conventional wisdom. You will see token models where you allow software customers to purchase tokens to then use the software or a part of the software against. And then there will be hybrid models where you have a base subscription or even a freemium model to use parts of the products. And then you pay as you go to use other features. For example, sometimes exports can be like that, etc. And then the way the subscription is being priced can be by features, can be by usage, can be by seats. There's different ways that you see. There's a terrific analyst out there at Saster who analyzes like a lot of these pricing models over the years. I would give them a follow for sure, because they really know what they're talking about in the SaaS arena.
Yeah. Okay, guys. Yeah, we'll be back next week. I'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Cheers.